You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Kaden toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. I'm your host, Kaden, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producers Beth and Olivia. Whai Akine, coming up on the show, I speak to Health Minister Dr. Aisha Varell and Greens MP Ricardo Menendez-March about both the Labour and Greens free dental policies and how they are different to each other. News and Editorial Director Jessica Hopkins talks to Senior Lecturer in Māori Education at the University of Waikato, Jennifer Smith, Ngāti Whātua Ngāpuhi, about their kaupapa to make Mātauranga Māori accessible to tamariki in Tuaiwi. Beth, what have you got for us today?
I speak to City Councillor for Manukau, Lotu Fuli, for City Councilling about Auckland Council's consultation around Māori seats and the upcoming Midtown Street Party. I also speak to Chair of Bike Auckland, Karen Horman, about their call to allocate a cycleway to the Harbour Bridge, referred to as Liberate the Lane. I also speak to organiser and spokesperson for Choose Clean Water, Marnie Prickett, about National and ACT's intentions around protecting Aotearoa's drinking water.
Olivia, what have you got for us today?
I speak to Chief Executive of WWF New Zealand, Dr. Kayla Kingdon-Bebb, about the impact of climate change on our wildlife and possible climate solutions.
He aha o whakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātui mai, text in on 5395 or Waia Marane, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Kaua e ware ware, e ahi, ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero ano he pakehere roki-roki mā runga i te pai tukutuku o irirangi poho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Councilling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
For this week's City Councilling, I talked to Auckland Councillor for Manukau, Lotu Fuli, about Auckland Council's consultation around Māori seats and the upcoming Midtown Street Party. Here is that interview. What is Auckland Council's plan with regards to Māori seats?
Yeah, so in the past, Auckland Council's governing body has agreed to support Māori seats. In the last term under Mayor Phil Goff, the governing body voted to support Māori seats in principle, but we weren't able to go ahead because we didn't have the legislation in place to allow that to happen. The legislation is now in place, but we're now going out for consultation. Obviously, we've got a new mayor and some new councillors, so we're going out for consultation and we want to hear from Aucklanders about their views on Māori seats. So that consultation's open now.
There has been a surprisingly low amount of submissions on whether or not to establish Māori seats. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think it might be a case of just, you know, consultation fatigue. We went through a huge process with the annual plan to get people to give us their feedback, and then straight after that we went into the local board's plan. So I think people are just a little bit tired and maybe a little bit over it. And then we've also got central government elections, so there's a lot of people competing for people's time. And so I think this might be one of the things that is just off people's radar, and maybe people aren't even aware that it's out, that the consultation's open. But I do hope that people do give their feedback because it is really important. It may transform the way that our council looks and certainly would be transformational in terms of representation for Māori. And it would be great to have young voices to hear from our university students because those are the voices that we're not getting coming through so far.
When does Auckland Council's consultation end and what would you like to impart with our listeners on this topic?
Oh, thank you for the question. So it ends on the 24th of September. So there's not long to go. 24th of September. You can do it online. It's actually a very quick survey or quick feedback form. You can just go to the Auckland Council website or go to my Facebook page and jump on the link or just Google Auckland Council Māori seats have your say or feedback and it'll come up. And I do encourage as many people as possible to have their say, because this is really an important possible change for the way that representation looks on our biggest council. Being mindful too that Auckland has the largest Maori population in New Zealand, but that has never been reflected in our governing body or even in our local boards. So it would be great to have people's feedback.
So the Auckland Midtown Street Party is coming up. What can people expect on this night?
Yeah, so that's really awesome. We haven't had something like this for a while because of the, you know, the lockdowns and everything else. So it's going to be on the 28th of September, so also not very far away. It's in the evening, so from about 6 p.m. and we'll go on through the night till about 9 p.m. or just after. And it's in that midtown region of our CBD, so around Elliot Street, Albert Street by the University, Victoria Street, Wellesley, and then down Queen Street as well. And people can expect to have lots of fun. There'll be lots of live music, entertainment, lots of really delicious food stalls, and people are displaying their art and culture as well. So it should be a really awesome vibe in that midtown heart of our city centre.
Amazing. Will there be bands and...
It'll be great. There'll be live music for sure. There'll be DJs. I think there'll be live entertainment. So I'm not sure if it'll be full-on bands or just, you know, singers and creatives, but there'll definitely be live music. I understand there will be some K-pop dancing as well, which I think, you know, people will find really fun too. But there will definitely be lots of live music, lots of art and culture on display as well. And I think there's going to be a light show. There'll be a special light display, a neon light display going on as well. So definitely awesome.
And how is the Midtown Street Party being funded this year?
Yeah, so it's 100% funded by Auckland Council, and it's funded through a targeted rate that we have for the city centre. So it's really using that targeted rate that we get from city centre businesses to try to reinvigorate and activate that space and encourage more people into that city centre space, that midtown space, hopefully to boost business for those businesses that have been really hard affected by COVID and the lockdown, and also by the roadworks and construction going on in the city.
That was Auckland City Councillor Lotu Fuli speaking to me about Auckland Council's plan for Māori seats and the upcoming Midtown Street Party.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95 BFM.
Around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
A University of Canterbury research team has been working with Tua Hiwi Whānau, including local kaumātua, on turning 5 Tuahiwi-based stories into children's picture books. News and editorial director Jessica Hopkins spoke to senior lecturer in Māori education at the University of Waikato, Jennifer Smith, Ngāti Whātua Ngāpuhi, about their kaupapa.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko tēnei te uri no Ngāti Whātua no Ngāpuhi, ko Jen Smith tēnei. Kia ora koutou, my name's Jen Smith, and my whakapapa is from the whānau, but I'm a senior lecturer here at Te Whare Wānanga o Waitaha at UC.
Can you tell our listeners about your kaupapa to make mātauranga Māori more accessible to young people?
There's lots of different ways in which we can capture mātauranga Māori, and this is one way. This study with Tua Hiwi builds on a similar pilot that we did with Taumutu through the Child Wellbeing Research Institute at UC. Collaborated with both Tua Hiwi School, the principal there, as well as a kaitiaki from Tua Hiwi Marae, Auntie Liz Kereru. And we saw a real need in our classrooms for picture books especially, but also little readers that really reflect the stories of our places. And so that kind of took off, and essentially what we did is we met with kaumātua and different whānau at Tua Hiwi Marae in types of wānanga, where we shared stories and we discussed their kind of experiences with the Tua Hiwi place. And then so we actually recorded all those and got all of those on video. We've got about 30 hours of wānanga and of stories of that place. And then essentially we worked with Auntie Liz as well as Lynn Tiaika to create these beautiful stories, storybooks for the kids. So yeah, that's kind of what we're in right now, is we're working with our local illustrators, Chris Harvey and her tamariki toho mairangi and akiaki, to illustrate those stories in ways that are really engaging and motivating for our kids, but also kind of capture those stories. So it's kind of making reality into these kind of fictional stories, but using different kaumātua and capturing their pāra, their tuahiwi marae, in all of those experiences that they had as kids. So we've got 5 books that we are just working in that kind of illustrating stage. They include stories about kapahaka, mahinga kai, so how they gather food, catching inango, inaka, so white baiting with Paul Ivan, and then a little bit of Kaiapoi Pā history. So we're really excited to deliver those both in te reo Māori, but also in that kind of bilingual English way that kind of the school, their philosophy is they've both got rūmaki, so they've both got immersion classrooms, but they also have bilingual classrooms so that they can be used in both the spaces, but also taken home and read with whānau.
What impact are you hoping that this project will have?
Well, we know through lots of our other culturally responsive work that the more that we can teach through identity, the more children connect themselves with their learning, but also gain a stronger sense of self-efficacy. And we know that that's really important as learners to have when you're learning anything. So especially with our 5-year-olds, our 5 to 7-year-olds, which we're going to pilot these with, it's really important that we get in early, and it's so exciting to see them connected to all the characters, the people that they know, who they're connected to, that they know these places, they know these stories. And so to put them in a book shows them that they really, their identity really has value and that they can learn through that, which is really exciting because I think for Te Wiki o Te Reo Māori especially, that's where we want education to go, where everyone can see themselves and learn through the ways of our tipuna.
Are there plans for these books to eventually be released to the general public?
The Tuahiwi Marae will retain sovereignty, so in terms of being released to the general public, that will be up to them, how they want to do it. Hopefully we will be working, and myself, Dr. Scott, and Dr. Kaylee Jones will be working in classrooms from Term 1 next year alongside the amazing teachers of Tuahiwi Kura. So we'll have them then, but when they actually get released to the wider public will be a conversation that the hapū needs to have, and we're really excited for them to have that kōrero, because these will be taonga for them to either share amongst their tuahiwi whānau, or if they deem it desirable, they'll send them out into the world.
That was News and Editorial Director Jessica Hopkins speaking to Senior Lecturer in Māori Education at the University of Waikato, Jennifer Smith, Ngāti Whātua Ngāpuhi, about their kaupapa to make Maturanga Māori stories more accessible to tamariki.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the B.
Hey, what's happening at Ponsonby Social Club this week?
Well, tonight there's
DJ Massmeyer, DJ Booth and Kirsty Sutherland.
And tomorrow,
DJs Junior and Cartier.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
I love Dick, you love Dick, we all love Dickity Dick Dick Dick. But asking are you clean can be pretty mean, now you're just being a Dick Dick Dick. When you're living with HIV, clean is the ultimate ick, major ick. And no one wants icks when they're trying to get dick. Eat a dick, ride a dick, just don't be a dick getting dick. See more Burnett Foundation Aotearoa on TikTok.
It's not his first rodeo, or his second rodeo, or even his third. It's his 6th rodeo. That's right, Tyler Childers has just released his 6th studio album, Rustin' in the Rain. Card holders, we're giving away copies. So, if it's not your first time around the rodeo, you know the drill. And stay tuned to 95BFM Drive all this week for your chance to win. Rustin' in the Rain, the new album from Tyler Childers. Available now where good music is found.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Bike Auckland has recently introduced Liberate the Lane, which is a call to introduce a cycling and walking lane to the Harbour Bridge. I spoke with Chair of Bike Auckland, Karen Horman, about this and began by asking her what exactly this venture is and what it would mean.
So Liberate the Lane is a campaign started by Bike Auckland to allocate a car lane or a vehicle lane currently being used to active modes so that people can walk, bike, or push a wheelchair or walk a dog or whatever way they want to get across the bridge.
What do you believe are the benefits of the implementation of a walking and cycling lane on the Harbour Bridge?
There's so many benefits to riding a bike for a start, which is obviously our key interest. And, you know, top of mind at the moment is cost of living. So riding a bike is the cheapest form of transport as far as getting some distance around the city, everything being accessible. It's the best way to travel. There is an upfront cost if you want an e-bike, but after that, costs are negligible, you know. So I know how much it's costing to fuel tank right now, so this is really relevant. There are also people who can't drive or don't want to drive, or people who are disabled. So that gives them the opportunity to utilise different ways of travel. I think there's a study in the UK where somewhere between 60 and 80% of disabled people can actually ride a bike. So that opens up a world to them that wasn't previously accessible. Then you have, you know, pollution, noise, and all the other negatives that go with your usual modes of transport. And, you know, biking gives great health outcomes.
So we could call it an issue of equity.
Well, it's an issue of cost of living, of equity, of climate, you know, the environment, health, you know, so that covers a lot of ground.
In terms of sort of looking at it practically, would a cycling lane be safe from the elements on the Harbour Bridge?
So we've come up with a report. It's been put together by an engineer experienced in traffic and civil engineering. And as well as assessing traffic flows, he's also come up with some suggestions about separators for the lane, about some fencing, weatherproofing to go on the bridge to make it safer. And there are other ideas, maybe ambassadors. Yeah, so there's a number of suggestions to make it safer and more appealing. You know, we'll have tourists going over there as well. So a lot of things can be done quite cheaply to make it safe and doable.
Why do you believe that this lane is necessary in all areas we've discussed?
The key thing is to actually get all of Auckland who wants to ride a bike or to walk or to use other modes of transport. We have to have a connected network. At the moment, the Harbour Bridge is a glaring gap. So you can't actually get from the North Shore to the city and back. At the moment, the only option, I think, is the Devonport Ferry. And there have been reports for the last 2 or 3 years that there are periods of time where that's oversubscribed and people with bikes are being told to wait for another ferry, which, you know, can add another half hour or more to their trip. So this is key to actually making this network connected and enabling people to actually ride a bike and get to where they want to go.
Do you think there is opportunity for more cycling lanes throughout the city? And if so, how would we go about this?
Absolutely. There's so many more opportunities for cycleways. The thing we come up against is the budget. So a lot of times cycleways have gone in as part of other bigger projects. So wind drainage, resurfacing, other maintenance projects are taking place. And this is a recent change. You know, maintenance used to mean putting it back exactly how it was, which in a lot of cases is not the best use of the funds. So now, you know, we're trying to advocate for cycle lanes to go in. There are also people advocating for safer pedestrianisation, safer access to bus stops, you know, and having a more systemic look at when we change our streets to make them friendly to the people who are not in cars. At the moment, the focus has, you know, historically been on the person in the car or the truck or the motorised vehicle.
Is this something the council could fund?
The council has the arm AT, and they have a certain amount of funding, but of course our recent council has gone into scarcity mode, and so AT has gone through a loss of jobs and a loss of funding. So we're all faced with how do we do things smarter and cheaper? And that may mean some pop-up infrastructure around the city, you know, where it's not the best standard. And some of it might not be as safe as we would want it, but some people will choose to use it. And it won't be all people. And this is the thing to realise, is that until there are safe, protected cycleways everywhere, there will be people who want to cycle who will choose not to because it's not safe.
So what would the first step be in implementing a cycleway on the Harbour Bridge? Is it advocacy for it?
Well, at the moment we've got two key activities. One is that we have a Liberate the Lane website, liberatethelane.nz, and on there is an open letter to Waka Kotahi, and you can access the report and you can sign on there as a business or as an individual and indicate your support for the project. And, you know, we're working on that to demonstrate that people want it and people will use it. At the same time, we have sent our report to Waka Kotahi, and, you know, we've had an initial discussion. And we have a good relationship with Waka Kotahi, and they do see the need. At the moment, the only provision for cycling or walking across the Harbour Bridge is linked with the Second Harbour Crossing, which is a $45 billion project, and will only deliver the walking and cycling piece at the end, which, you know, our estimate could be, you know, 15 years optimistically, but, you know, could be 20, could be more. And for us, that, you know, with a climate crisis in front of us, that seems, yeah, it's not feasible.
So we need to get this happening.
We need to get this happening, and we believe that walking and cycling across the Harbour Bridge is doable. It's possible, and we could do it now.
That was Chair of Bike Auckland, Karen Horman, speaking to me about Bike Auckland's Liberate the Lane, a call to allocate a cycling and walking lane to the Harbour Bridge.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Multiple political parties have announced their own free dental policy for this election. The Greens announced their free dental policy in August, with Labor following with their own announcement for free dental for under 30s earlier this month. I started by speaking to the Honourable Dr. Aisha Varel, Minister for Health, about Labor's free dental policy and why they have chosen to restrict their policy to under 30s. Here is that interview. Why is dental a health priority?
Well, it's really been odd that we haven't had dental as part of our universal health system. The Labor government started doing that in 1938, but we never really finished the job. And now is the time, after the health reforms, where we can get on restarted with that. Teeth are a really important part of your health, and we know that people who don't get preventive dental end up in hospital. So it's important to make sure we can improve access there.
Why has it taken so long to treat dental care like other aspects of our healthcare system?
Yeah, I guess it's historic, really, and we couldn't, when it first started in the 1930s, public health system, dental wasn't included, and I guess with successive governments, there was so much budget pressure in the health system day to day that getting on with this extension never really was a priority. But I know many people, including many activists in the Labor Party, have had this as a priority. We need to move on, so I'm pleased that we can put it up as part of this election campaign. And hopefully in the next 3 years, see a substantial increase in the number of people able to access free dental.
Who will Labor's dental policy cover?
Yeah, so currently up to the age of 18, you can get free dentistry. So we'll extend that to include everyone under 30. In 2025, by July 2025, will open up to people who are under 23 and under, and then 30 and under by 2026.
We know that right now people turn 18 and just stop going to the dentist because it becomes unaffordable. Won't this just happen at 30 now? So isn't it not really solving the problem?
Yeah, obviously we have a vision of free universal dental for all, and extending up to 30 is a really important step we can take towards that. It brings 800,000 people into receiving free dental who don't currently. There's another reason as well, the evidence from the Dunedin long-term study where they followed people up for over 40 years now shows that people who start missing dental care in their 20s
go on to have far worse outcomes than those who continue it in their 20s. And that, you know, it really identified this group of young adults who often don't have the money to go to the dentist. Often they're still in training or early in employment and don't have high wages. You know, it's a really important group that we act to support because the cost is a really big barrier for them.
Other parties have announced their own free dental policy before this, but for universal coverage across age groups and to be implemented sooner, why does Labor believe this policy is better?
Yeah, obviously our cousins in the Greens are really aligned with us on the importance of this issue. I think for us the question is just making sure for Labor we want to put something we think is realistic and achievable into the next 3 years of government. And I think one of the challenges is making sure that we've got the sector lined up in terms of the number of dentists that provide this care. We know, you know, across the board there are issues with the health workforce, so giving ourselves the time to make sure we're remunerating dentists properly by reviewing their contracts. We'll do that in the first year, and then secondly seeing if we need to do any international recruitment and to do that. That's what having the staged and responsible rollout means.
How will you make sure there are enough dentists available for this to be implemented?
Yeah, so firstly, we know that there are a lot of dentists who aren't offering subsidised dental care at the free dental care to the under-18s at the moment because that combined dental agreement needs to be reviewed. So that's the first thing we will do. And we think we can release extra visit time in the existing workforce. Then the next thing we'll do is work with the Dental Council to see if alternative ways of configuring roles, meaning that that work could be distributed across other workers, not just dentists, will be another step we can take. And then thirdly, we can do targeted international recruitment, currently international recruitment is done by individual practices, so it's on an ad hoc basis. If we run a large government campaign to do international recruitment, we think we'll be more successful and we'll be able to fill any gaps we have if the other two measures don't work.
Isn't not having enough dentists to fulfil universal free dental, similar to what other parties have proposed, like the Greens, just evidence that our healthcare system depends on there not being able to afford healthcare? And if it is, how do we make sure we counter that on a bigger scale without just implementing band-aid solutions?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. But firstly, on the workforce side of things, across the board, we're making a commitment to grow domestic trained workforces through our workforce plan. But look, I see the big issue with our health system is it's orientated in the wrong direction, and that we've always prioritised funding for expensive treatments and never made the investments in early intervention and prevention that we should. This last term of government, we've made huge strides in that area. Smoke-free, fluoridating water, folate and bread, primary mental health services, over 600 sites around the country. And then dental will be another example of that. My overall philosophy as someone who practiced as a doctor is that the way we get ahead of all of our funding pressures in the health system is early intervention, and that's why we've prioritised all these things. So we know if we implement this policy and fund the basics of dental care, that stop a little bit of plaque from becoming a hole, from becoming an abscess that needs a trip to hospital, that's how we're going to turn these costs and pressures on the health system around.
I then spoke to Greens MP and health spokesperson Ricardo Menendez-March about the Greens' own free dental policy, how it's different from Labor's, and how they hope to implement it. Here is that interview. Why have the Greens made free dental a key priority this election?
We know that far too many people in Aotearoa are living with unmet dental care needs, often in excruciating pain, having to miss out on going to school and work, and cost should not be a barrier to access dental care, which is why we've committed to laying out a comprehensive plan to provide free dental for everyone, not just under 30s, paid for by a wealth tax.
Labor has proposed what is essentially a weaker version of your dental policy because they have said it is the only achievable way to implement free dental. Why don't the Greens agree with this?
Labor does not have the political courage to tax the wealthy few to adequately fund our public health services. And the Green Party is bringing a plan which will guarantee that everyone, no matter your age, is able to afford to go to the dentist. What we're also committing is to ensuring that we build our public health delivery for providing free dental as opposed to relying on subsidies for the private sector.
How will you make sure there are enough dentists available for this to be implemented?
We know that in the short term for basic dental treatment, we can tap into the workforce that is already there, but we've committed to increasing the cap on the number of dentists that we train each year and fund our tertiary education institutions so that we can have more dentists and specialists available, particularly to come into the public health workforce so that everyone can get access to the treatment they need.
Are there enough dentists right now for this to be implemented, though?
We're confident that we have enough dentists right now to provide basic care for people, but for more specialist type of care, we do acknowledge we need to train more people, and this is why we'll lift the cap on the number of dentists that we provide. What the Greens will also do to ensure that we're able to reach hard-to-access communities, such as in rural areas, is funding dental vans, which at the moment play a critical role to support under-18s in rural communities.
The fact that we don't have enough dentists right now for everyone to be able to access dental care is kind of just evidence that our healthcare system depends on there being people not able to afford healthcare. Do the Greens have any plans on how we can counter this on a bigger scale while avoiding band-aid solutions?
Training more dentists and actually building our public health workforce is critical to ensuring that going to the dentist isn't a luxury for people. But beyond that, what we'll also do by eliminating poverty and addressing the social determinants of oral health will be to also prevent people from having poor oral health because they don't have access to an abundance of nutritious kai and a warm, healthy home to live in.
So the solution for our healthcare system goes way beyond healthcare. It comes with things like housing, is what you're saying?
We need to make sure that we're not just pumping resources into the healthcare system, but work holistically to address the reasons why people get sick in the first place. And we know that far too many people are presenting to the hospital and to the dentist for conditions that come from poverty. So the Greens are laying out a comprehensive plan to not just make dental free for everyone, but also to end poverty for all families, which will take a massive burden off the healthcare system as well.
In our healthcare system, we have unequal outcomes, Māori and Pacifica being especially impacted by those negative outcomes. Do the Greens have a plan to counter those inequities?
We know we have to diversify our oral health workforce and bring more Māori and Pacifica into dentistry, which is why the Greens will resource scholarships for Māori and Pacifica students and provide better income support for students so that those students are able to complete their degrees.
That was Labor Minister Dr. Aisha Varell and Greens MP Ricardo Menendez-March on their party's respective free dental policies.
The government has indicated
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the B.
Auckland's favourite summer festival is back for 2024.
That's right. St. Jerome's Laneway Festival is here. Darling. Happening at Western Springs on Waitangi Day, Tuesday, February 6th.
And as always, they have stacked the chilli bin chock-a-full of the coolest local and international musical acts. Featuring
Stormzy,
Steve Lacey,
Dominic Fike,
Unknown Mortal Orchestra,
AJ Tracy,
David,
Dope Lemon,
Idris,
Faye Webster,
Horse Girl,
Near Archives,
Paris, Texas,
Pretty Girl,
Ray,
Skin on Skin,
Suki Waterhouse,
Atsurangi,
Blonde Shell,
Church,
Daily J,
Dommy and JD Beck,
Ernie Bell,
Hunby,
Hemlock Springs,
and Molly Payton.
St. Jerome's Laneway Festival 2024.
Waitangi Day, Tuesday, February 6th. Last year, the tickets sold out in record time. Tickets on sale now at lanewayfestival.com.
I haven't voted before because I feel like my voice isn't heard.
But I'm not the only one.
If we all had a say
on the issues that matter to us
and our communities,
that'll be powerful, right?
Yep.
Let's make our voices heard by voting in this year's general election.
Brought to you by the Electoral Commission.
Clementine Valentine, the artists formerly known as Purple Pilgrims,
are about to embark on a tour to celebrate their new record, The Coin That Broke the Fountain Floor.
And beautiful B-card holders, you could save your coins by winning a ticket. Just stay tuned to 95BFM Breakfast all week for your cue to enter.
95BFM presents Clementine Valentine, September 16th at Whammy Bar. Tickets on sale now at banishedmusic.com.
Well, what a phenomenal thing for you to say.
The Wire.
Climate change continues to be hugely impactful, with experts saying many of Aotearoa New Zealand's wildlife species remain at risk of harm and extinction. WWF New Zealand has emphasised the importance of nature in mitigating the effects of climate change on our wildlife. I spoke to Chief Executive of WWF New Zealand, Dr. Kayla Kingdon-Bebb, about the need for the government to do more to mitigate climate change and potential climate solutions. In Aotearoa, New Zealand, what are some of the biggest impacts climate change is having on our wildlife?
We know that climate change is going to be a significant risk going forward for all of our native species and ecosystems. And you might be aware, but biodiversity in New Zealand is in a pretty bad state. Already, 63% of our indigenous ecosystems are threatened, and fully a third of our native species are threatened or at risk of extinction. That's fairly incredible. And in Aotearoa, that means 90% of our seabird species, 82% of our resident native birds, 94% of our reptiles, and 72% of our freshwater fish. And we know that climate change is going to exacerbate the pressures on those already threatened species.
What is WWF doing to limit climate change?
Climate change, both mitigation and adaptation, is a really big focus for WWF in Aotearoa and internationally. We run a number of different projects on the ground, and we fund community conservation efforts, including on projects that are focused on nature-based solutions, which are interventions that look to try and either do climate change mitigation or adaptation and to address biodiversity loss at the same time. So a really good example of a nature-based solution would be restoring a wetland, a coastal wetland. We know that wetlands sequester carbon, so they're great for climate change mitigation. They also can prevent flood inundation in king tides and big weather events, so they're great for adaptation. And wetlands are also incredibly important for our number of indigenous species in terms of their habitat. New Zealand's lost something like 90% of its wetlands since colonization, which is an incredible amount. So projects like that are things we're really keen to support. So that's an example of the kind of projects we fund on the ground in Aotearoa. But another really important role for WWF is influencing political decision making. So we regularly meet with ministers, including the Prime Minister quarterly, and opposition parties to strongly advocate for more action on climate change and biodiversity loss.
What are some solutions you think are being underutilized by government?
Well, I'd say kind of the same thing, actually. So we obviously there's these commitments in the Emissions Reduction Plan and the National Adaptation Plan to prioritize nature-based solutions and to really focus on ensuring that climate action is biodiversity positive. But to date, we haven't really seen a lot of meaningful investment in that. And that is something New Zealand's approach to climate action is evolving, and we'll see what happens after the election. But the budget cycle every year since 2021, we've had a climate emergency response fund called the SURF Fund, which was created in 2021 with about $4.5 billion as its initial sort of pot, which is a huge amount of money for a New Zealand budget process. And the SURF Fund has been used to fund climate action across the board. So whether it's things like Ihirangi, the Māori climate platform, or interventions to support industry transformation, most of that money has been coming out of SURF. And what we'd really like to see going forward is a stronger focus on SURF being directed to nature-positive interventions and investments. But what you should probably know is that SURF is, kind of a hot topic in the election, and some of the parties are actually pledging to do away with it, which is something that WWF is incredibly concerned about.
In WWF's view, what are the most important policies you would like to see the incoming government adopt?
Well, as an ENGO, our focus is really on outcomes for people and planet. And so there's a few different things. I mean, first, we're really, really concerned that New Zealand continues its work on climate action. You would have heard, and I'm sure a number of students at Auckland University would have heard, that in addition to possibly defunding the Climate Emergency Response Fund, which means basically all of Aotearoa's climate action, a number of parties are focusing, purely to focus on adaptation and to sort of just give up on trying to reduce our emissions. And I'm really concerned about that, and I think it's incredibly unfair on future generations, because if we give up on trying to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees, we're actually taking away choices from younger generations and the generations that come after them. And I think that is A, dangerous, and B, morally wrong. We're really focused on ensuring that a future government commits to the targets that have been set, that New Zealand set under the Paris Agreement and that are enshrined in the Zero Carbon Act, that they accelerate climate action and they do it in a way that is biodiversity positive. That is one area that we are still going really hard on. The other area that WWF is really concerned about in Aotearoa is around the state of our marine environment. Te Moana and the various marine species and ecosystems within it are in a pretty diabolical state, actually. And New Zealand has the fifth largest ocean territory on the planet. Something like $7.4 billion of our economy annually relies on activities in the marine environment. And we know that a lot of our indigenous species in the marine environment are really, really struggling, like 90% of seabirds, which is incredible. And beyond that, we know that, spatial protection, so marine protected areas, are really important for restoring biodiversity and giving those species a safe haven through which to survive. And they're also really important for climate mitigation and adaptation, because healthy marine ecosystems sequester carbon and they also prevent big weather events from affecting communities. And it might alarm you to know that currently less than 0.5% of New Zealand's ocean territory is protected. Less than 0.5%. Globally, we signed up to a target for 30% of the planet's oceans to be protected by 2030. So we have a long ways to go there. And what is also alarming to me is that in terms of global standing, where Aotearoa sits against other countries for protecting its ocean territory, we sit at joint last place. Can you imagine that? We are joint last with Russia and with China for how we take care of our ocean territory. Looking ahead into the next term of government, we really want to see some more action to protect the marine environment now and for future generations.
That was Chief Executive of WWF New Zealand, Dr. Kayla Kingdon-Bibb, speaking to me about climate change's impact on wildlife and possible solutions.
That was The Wire.
Ko era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I korero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Nē rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1-4 with Eli, but before that we have Masterpiece by Big Thief.
Years, days, makes no difference to me, babe. You look exactly the same to me. Ain't no time
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.